On This Week in Enterprise Tech, I talk about Google finding vulnerabilities in your iPhone. Plus, we have a special guest. Padre Este is back, and he takes us through VMworld and all of its goodness. Plus, Padre Curtis, Brian, and I talk with David Link, CEO of Science Logic, about AI ops and digital enterprise challenges. Twiet on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twiet.
This is Twiet, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 357, recorded August 30th, 2019. Changes in network monitoring. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by NetScout. Meeting the digital demands of today starts with a bold new IT strategy. NetScout is delivering a new perspective, visibility without borders, to guide your digital success and data center transformation. Get seamless visibility and monitoring for performance and security. See how at netscout.com. Welcome to Twiet, This Week Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I'm your host, Louis Maresca, your guide to this big, giant world of the enterprise, but I definitely don't want to guide you by myself. So let's bring in the professionals, the experts in this field, starting with the very own Mr. Curtis Franklin, senior editor at Dark Reading. Curtis, you've been a busy bee writing about fuzzing, but you're also preparing for a megathon, is that right?
Well, preparing for a make-a-thon the weekend of the 13th and 14th. But before we get there, we're preparing for a little visitor called Dorian down here in the Sunshine State. Pretty much everyone is out loading up on supplies, taking care of getting their preparations in order, and doing all of the either battening down of hatches or loading up the car and getting ready to head north. So it's an exciting weekend here in Florida, getting ready to go for even more excitement. And I'll talk about that make-a-thon when we sign off today, because lots of fun stuff happening there.
Fantastic. Well, hopefully you'll stay safe and I'll just bypass you by. Well, folks, we also have our other co-host in crime and our geek in paradise is not seeing that type of weather. Mr. Brian Chee, Director, Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu. Cheaper, you've been busy looking for funding, but also building Node-RED solutions, right?
Yes, indeed. I discovered that the Node-RED dashboard does indeed resize very nicely. So, unfortunately, I've got to go and try and get it working with Let's Encrypt certificates so that I don't have to keep retyping the whole address. One of the things that's actually happening that's very cool is there's a whole bunch of new materials coming out for the 3D printing market. And I'm actually really looking forward to it. These materials are getting more and more advanced, and one of the ceramic materials might actually work as a heat shield for low Earth orbit sample recovery.
Fantastic, fantastic. Well, folks, we have an enterprise packed show today. Now we're going to go over some Google news, where it includes Google's Play app executing some payload, secret payloads on your machine. But also there's Project Zero, and they're finding some iPhone exploits. Plus, we have a surprise guest to take us through VMworld and their announcements and trends to watch from there. And of course, we have Dave Link, CEO of Science Logic, to talk about AI apps and digital enterprise challenges. But before we get into all that goodness, let's go ahead and jump into this week's blips. Now, it wouldn't be a week without some sort of security exploit or attack. Now, Google's Project Zero is back in the news, and this time it's reporting that Apple's iPhone users have been open to attack for years. Now, luckily, there is a patch, but the exploit goes as far back as iOS 10 to the latest version of iOS 12. Now, that's right. You thought your little iPhone was safe, now, didn't you? Now, for at least 2 years, a smart collection of hacked websites have been affecting iPhones in a massive campaign affecting thousands of devices. Now, these sites quietly infiltrated iPhones through indiscriminate watering hole attacks using previously unknown vulnerabilities. Now, the attack affected website received thousands of weekly visitors, highlighting the severity of the campaign that upsets the reputation of security on Apple products. Now, Google's threat analysis group, or TAG team, found 5 exploit chains nearly covering every operating system released from iOS 10 to iOS 12. And then these chains connected security flaws so attackers could bypass several layers of the protection. In total, they exploited 14 vulnerabilities, several affecting Safari browser, 5 for the kernel, 2 sandbox escapes, and more. And when unsuspecting victims actually access these malicious websites, which have been alive since 2017, this site would evaluate the device. If the iPhone was vulnerable, it would load monitoring malware. Now, this was primarily used to steal files and upload users' live location data. The malware granted access to all of this victim's database files used by apps like WhatsApp, Telegram, and iMessage, so attackers could view plain text messages sent and received. Now, if you think you will know that this will happen on your device, and when it does happen, you are wrong. There's no visual cues or indicators to tell the victim that the implant is running. Now, Google initially discovered this campaign in February and reported it to Apple, giving the iPhone maker 1 week to fix the problem. Apple patched it in iOS 12.14, released on February 7, 2019. Now, if you already know what I'm going to say, but if you want to ensure your organization is safe from attacks like these, make sure you're installing and updating.
Well, in news that really surprises no one, SOC analysts are overburdened, and they're responding by shifting their priorities. We have yet another red flag that the Security Operations Center, or SOC, is burning. Most SOC analysts now say their primary role is to close alert investigations, or the number of alerts, as quickly as possible, rather than to study and remediate the threats. A new survey says that last year, some 70% of SOC analysts said the reverse. They saw their main job is analyzing and fixing security threats and issues. But the managed detection response firm's Critical Start's newest survey, which was published this week, had only 41% saying that's their priority. Most, more than 70%, handle 10 or more security alerts per day, a serious increase over last year when 45% were operating at that workload. SOCs are also getting hit with false positive security alerts at a rate of 50% or higher, according to the report, and nearly 40% say that when SOC analysts can't keep up with alerts, they either turn off some alerting functions or try to hire more analysts. One guess as to which most companies leap to. This latest study is yet another in a string of recent SOC reports this year, underscoring the growing problem of an overwhelming and impossible volume of security alerts to sift through for the needle in the haystack that's a true security problem. Much of the stress in the SOC comes from analysts surrounded by too many security tools that don't work well together, or that they don't have time or resources to fully master, as more alerts bombard their screens each and every day. They just don't have the time or expertise to master the tools or stay on top of the alerts these systems pump out. An overwhelmed SOC can result in dangerously long times to resolve and remediate an attack. Some 42% of the SOC analysts in a recent report by the Poneman Institute say it takes months or even years on average to resolve a hack.
Well, the perils of Google Play are once again on display with the discovery of an app with nearly 100 million downloads that contained a malicious component that downloaded secret payloads onto infected Android devices. Throughout most of its life, Cam Scanner was a legitimate app that provided useful functions for scanning and managing documents, according to researchers from the antivirus provider Kaspersky Lab. To make money, the developers displayed ads and offered in-app purchases. Well, then at some point, things changed. The app was updated to add an advertising library that contained a malicious module. This component was what's known as a Trojan dropper, meaning it regularly downloaded encrypted code from a developer designated server at https://abc.abcdserver.com. And then decrypted and executed on infected devices. The module with Kaspersky Lab researchers named TrojanDropper.AndroidOS.Necro.N could download and execute whatever the developers wanted at any time. The developers said that they had previously found Trojan Dropper lurking side apps that are pre-installed on some phones sold in China. Quote, the above-described Trojan dropper Android and OS Necro.n functions carry out the main task of the malware, quote, to download and launch a payload from malicious servers, a separate post from Kaspersky Lab explained. As a result, the owners of the module can use an infected device to their benefit in any way they see fit, from showing the victim intrusive advertising to stealing money from their mobile account by charging paid subscriptions. This is a very sad commentary on today's app market, in that we've gotten so used to really inexpensive mobile apps, and as a knee-jerk reaction, a huge number of app developers have gone to adding sometimes unvetted ad systems that in this case led to a very unfortunate vulnerability. Are you willing to pay a bit more for an app that doesn't need third-party ads and apps? I think I would pay for quality and safety. Will you?
Now, you probably remember hearing about the massive data breach that was disclosed by the FBI and Capital One back in July. Now, this was actually a fairly large breach, which exposed personal and financial data for more than 100 million customers. Now, the FBI arrested former Amazon employee Paige Thompson in connection with the crime and accused her of also breaching 30 other companies and organizations. Now, an indictment unsealed this past week offers a much fuller picture of the government's allegations against her and the scope of her alleged hack spree. Now, if you remember, we reported Thompson, aka Erratic, who allegedly created a program in late March to scan cloud customers for specific web application firewall misconfigurations. Now, the interesting part here is, even though she worked for Amazon AWS, her prior role at the company didn't lend her to any inside access in this case. Now, once the tool that she created found its targeted misconfiguration, it was allegedly exploited to extract privileged account credentials for victim databases and other web applications. However, there is more to this story. Not only did she remove the data after using the stolen credentials, the indictment also claims that in some cases she used this access to set up cryptocurrency mining operations using victims' cloud computing power, practice known as cryptojacking. Now, all the data that Thompson allegedly stole didn't necessarily contain personal identifiable information, but in the case of Capital One, the breach exposed 106 million credit card applications, which included names, addresses, phone numbers, and dates of birth, along with 140,000 social security numbers and 80,000 bank account numbers and some credit scores and transaction data. Now, there actually is additional bad news here, and we have no idea what actually happened to the data once it was removed. Now, if you or your organization is worried about the breach and where the data has gone, it's recommended you take the steps to ensure credit monitoring and mail filtering in the foreseeable future.
Well, Google is doing something good. They have launched new and expanded bug bounty programs. Google is upping its security game with the launch of a new Developer Data Protection Reward Program, or DDPRP, and the significant expansion of the Google Play Security Rewards Program, or GPSRP. According to the company, GPSRP will now include all Google Play apps with 100 million or more installs. And the significant change is that these apps will be eligible for bug bounty payments even if the app publisher doesn't run its own bug bounty program. Now, for those apps from publishers who do have existing bug bounty programs, the GDSRP will now pay bug bounties in addition to those paid by the publisher. Now, the new DDPRP is being operated in collaboration with HackerOne. The program is aimed at data abuse issues in Android apps, in OAuth projects, and in Chrome extensions. The program, according to Google in an announcement, is intended to reward any researcher providing, quote, verifiably and unambiguous evidence of data abuse, end quote. Google noted that it's particularly interested in situations where user data is being sold unexpectedly or repurposed in an illegitimate manner without user consent.
Well, seven of the nation's top book publishers sued Amazon subsidiary Audible this last Friday, asking federal courts to block the company from releasing a new feature called Audible Captions that's due out next month. The technology does exactly what it sounds like: display text captions on the screen of your phone or tablet as the corresponding words are read in the audio file. The publishers argue that this is straight up copyright infringement. In their view, the law gives them the right to control the distribution of their books in different formats. Audio is a different format from text, they reason, so Audible needs a separate license. Now, this would be a slam dunk argument if Audible were generating PDFs of entire books and distributing them to customers alongside the audio files. But what Audible is doing is subtly different in a way that could provide the company with firm legal ground to stand upon. The caption feature is not and was never intended to be a book, Audible explained in an online statement following the lawsuit. Quote, listeners cannot read at their own pace or flip through pages as they could with a print book or ebook. Instead, the purpose is to allow listeners to follow along with a few lines of machine-generated text as they listen to the audio performance. We disagree with the claims that this violates any rights and look forward to working with publishers and members of the professional creative community to help them better understand the educational and accessibility benefits of this innovation, Audible added. Audible hasn't fully explained how Audible captions worked, but the company has said enough to provide a pretty clear picture. In a video about the service released earlier this month, an Audible executive explained that the technology was built upon publicly available technology through AWS Transcribe. That's Amazon's cloud-based service for automatic text transcription. The Audible case hinges upon a previous landmark case, the 1984 decision of Sony versus Universal to declare the VCR legal. Hollywood argued that the record button on the VCR was an invitation for customers to infringe their copyrights. But the Supreme Court disagreed, arguing that copyright's fair use doctrine allowed time shifting, recording a show now to play later. So, strictly my opinion, this is similar to how song lyrics are scrolled on my Echo show as a song plays. Super useful, especially for songs like Elton John's Benny and the Jets or Mick Jagger's Jumpin' Jack Flash, because I'm sorry, Mick, enunciate. To bring this back to the enterprise world, what's going to happen when AI finally gets into the consumer world and consumers use it to add, say, foreign language translated subtitles for, say, live podcasts like Twyatt?
Now, the World AI Conference commenced this past week and housed heavy influencers like Jack Ma, Pony Ma, to Tesla's founder, Elon Musk. Now, the influence of the conference starts with the actual attendees themselves. Now, Elon Musk's presence at the important Beijing-endorsed AI symposium lends credence to China's vision of becoming the world leader in AI technology by 2030. Now, Musk was there for the conference, but also was there to take the cover off the China chapter of his boring company, Passion Project. Now, Musk surely knows what's brewing in China. Chinese AI has raised eyebrows in Washington like no other segment of the company's vast corporate machine, in part because of the barrage of daily headlines proclaiming how China may soon surpass the U.S. in this tech. Now, there are some serious technology in this area coming out to light due to their newfound focus in this area. Now, found anything from autonomous driving and robot waiters to facial recognition systems, names like Megvii Technologies and Sense Time Group Limited, both backed by Alibaba Group Holdings, and are showing the way the industry. Now, Megvii, backed by the sum of the nation's most prominent state firms and tech corporations, filed in the last week for an IPO that can raise as much as $1 billion, stirring the industry even more. Now, after all this movement, it's only a matter of time to see a response from Washington and the U.S.-based corporations that actually look to AI as their next venture as well. Only a crystal ball can tell us the next chapter. We'll have to wait and see. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, we get to bring in a surprise guest to take us through VMworld. But before we get to that, we have to thank a great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that is NetScout. Now, IT organizations know that to have consistent visibility and troubleshooting, basically at the application level, are really imperative to its successful deployment or refactoring or even operation of critical business services within their data center. Now, they all kind of desire this, and they actually increasingly require built-in automation, applications for both network monitoring and performance, and also having reliability so they can make sure that they have to do it and have reliable systems. But it's kind of fragmented. They have really low-resolution data. While accelerating innovation and operational agility can meet the demands of today's digital, starts with a bold new IT strategy. Now, as the pace of change continues to exponentially increase, so does the risk of failure. Now, raising the stakes for CIOs, architects, and IT operations. Now, simply put, digital transformation has changed the game. But NetScout has a different perspective, one that was built for the era of digital and data center transformation. It is called Visibility Without Borders. Now, it's allowing organizations to manage risk better and accelerate digital transformation by providing continuous, unified, reliable data of the risks and performance status of applications or workloads, whether they reside on physical, software, or public cloud instances. Now, this real-time visibility extends to wherever your technology infrastructure and business applications reside. Now, NetScout offers and provides an early warning system that can rapidly pinpoint application and service-level performance risks and enables real-time triage to resolve problems. Now, NetScout's platform is unique to its scalable distributed architecture, which stores and processes data at the collection point, including the virtual system vStream, which actually provides visibility of east to west traffic deep into the application stack, and then it actually forwards it on to relevant indicators in real time to a single monitoring analysis platform, which actually loses and provides the ability to store that data and provide information back. Now, as the world leader in transforming packet data, NetScout Smart Data delivers high resolution and continuous monitoring across the network and data center, cloud, 5G, and more. Now, already in use monitoring and securing some of the world's most critical commercial and public service infrastructures, NetScout's next generation level visibility provides the holistic perspective that IT teams are seeking. See more at netscout.com. That's NetScout, NetScout.com. And we thank NetScout for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's now time for us to bring in a special guest that takes us through VMworld 2019. And he is the father of This Week in Enterprise Tech and our resident expert at finding massage stations at conferences, especially VMworld, our very own Father Robert Ballister, Padre Este. Welcome back, Padre.
Lou, thank you. It's so good to be back. It's like coming back into an old apartment and just knowing where everything is.
Absolutely.
By the way, that massage station at VMworld, that was no joke. That was awesome, especially since every other conference I've gone to, the massage stations are always taken up. And I don't think most people knew about this, so I may have gotten a few, two extra. Sorry about that, VMworld.
Got it. I get it, though. You're walking around, you're in these conferences. Sometimes they can be a little boring, and you also get a little tense walking around, so you need a little bit of a massage to keep things flowing. But I guess that there's lots of excitement there at VMworld. Maybe you can take us through some of the common themes that you've seen there, that you saw there?
Absolutely. So, I mean, if you've listened to, watched, read any of the coverage from VMworld 2019, you know that the big thing was Kubernetes. It was Kubernetes, Kubernetes, Kubernetes. If every keynote, every major address at some way, shape, or form had that integrated into the presentation. And so that's the low-hanging fruit. That's the easy target. If someone were to ask you what VMworld 2019 was all about, you could just say, oh, well, they're doing K8. I don't think so, though. I think there is an overarching trend that actually goes beyond just Kubernetes, and that is the fact that at VMworld 2019, you're starting to see the emergence of this idea that instead of asking on-prem, hybrid, private cloud, instead of asking, am I using a VM? Am I using a container? Instead of asking, am I going to be going with a VDI solution or am I going with something more like remote desktops that are a bit more secure, VMworld 2019 said yes. All of those things. If you look at the various companies that are closely tied to VMware, and I'm talking about, of course, Dell, which owns 82% of VMware, and Pivotal, and now Carbon Black, and Microsoft with their partnership, and of course Dell, you can see that they're trying to recreate themselves as the nuts to bolts vendor. They can literally take you from the development of your applications to the deployment of your servers to your users, all within the same platform. And I think that's, for me, that's the exciting overarching trend.
Okay, Padre. I've got a question, though. Mm. You mentioned VDI. I was under the impression that VDI was kind of a zombie walking around and that it had its heyday and never came up. Are you hearing differently from VMworld?
Absolutely. Now, like you, I remember VDI hit the stage and it took it was a big splash. Everyone was talking about it. They were saying, oh, this is how the future of the enterprise is going to look. And then it kind of disappeared because it was expensive, it was slow, and infrastructure just really wasn't there to support it. Well, Dell had a huge push into VDI, and they were pushing their new VX block solutions, which basically allows you to control every aspect of your user's desktop, no matter where they are, in the building, operating in the cloud, or operating way off the cloud. So they weren't pushing it. It wasn't like the last time we heard about VDI when they were saying, this is the next best thing, this is the next best thing. They're now selling VDI as, well, if you already buy into this virtual infrastructure, if you already do hybrid cloud, if you already do both VMs and containers, then VDI is just something you get. And I think that is it's a far better solution. That's a more winning solution because it tells the users, we're not trying to sell you something. We're trying to make you use something you already have. That's good.
Now, there's been a lot of announcements, obviously, at VMware. Tons of announcements, actually. Lots of acquisitions, lots of announcements. What was the major theme there? I mean, it seems like they're focusing on Kubernetes quite a bit. And with things like, Tanzu, which actually, interesting enough, is Swahili for branches, is kind of bridging the edge-to-edge solution for Kubernetes types involvement. Is that what you were seeing there? Is like mostly focusing on that?
Yes, absolutely. Okay, so Project Tanzu, that was the big one. That was the big announcement. That's the one that got all the buzz going. And that's why everyone thinks that the entire show was about Kubernetes. Now, what Project Tanzu is, and remember, this is not available now. There is Tanzu that you can get and you can play with, but most of the features that people want are going to be available at a future date. It allows you to create a native Kubernetes platform, a native container platform within VMware vSphere. So in other words, you no longer have to choose between running VMs or running containers or doing some bastardized mix of the two. You can have one hypervisor that does both equally well. That's what got people excited, because if they don't have to choose between running a container system or running a virtual machine system or running some sort of bastardization where you have a container system running inside of a VM, you have way more options. It means you don't have to redevelop your applications and your services every time you want to switch platforms. Now, along with Project Pacific, which was the main chunk of Tanzu, you also had Mission Control. Now, Mission Control was the part of Tanzu that gave you the single pane of glass to monitor, to manage all Kubernetes instances. And that's all. I mean all. That means on private cloud, on public cloud. The homebrew Kubernetes containers and clusters, you can now see from a single pane of glass. That, for me, was more exciting than anything else, because if you give me a single point to interface with everything that I'm running, it makes my job a lot easier. You've also got, I mean, you must have heard about the acquisitions, right? I mean, the acquisitions were the ones that really kind of got people wondering what was going on there. They made a $2.7 billion acquisition of Pivotal Orb. They're going to close it. They made a $2.1 billion acquisition of Carbon Black. And they also got Bitnami, and they didn't say how much that was going to cost. And a lot of people were looking at those acquisitions and saying, we're not exactly sure what you get. I mean, that's a lot of money considering the fact that VMware made $2.4 billion last quarter. So this is $5-plus billion in acquisitions in a single day. Why did you do this? They basically had access to Pivotal. Pivotal is actually spun off from EMC in 2015, and they're acquiring it for the same IPO price, $15 a share, that Pivotal originally went for. So what do they want it for? Pivotal doesn't actually give you anything that VMware doesn't already do. Now, you have to also remember that you can think of Pivotal as sort of a secure app incubator. It gives developers a secure space to spin up these new services, these new projects, and then auto-deploy to the cloud. Well, that's great, and it sounds good, and it does work. It's a decent solution. But you've also got solutions that do the same thing from Microsoft, from AWS. Even IBM has a public-private hybrid cloud deployment solution. So why did VMware do that? Also with Carbon Black. Carbon Black is all about security. But there's already security baked into VMware's products. So why did they spend $2.1 billion to get something that they already have? And I think the trend among the attendees was to start looking not at, well, that's a product they already have, but rather that's a product that no longer competes with VMware. which is sort of like the way that the Yankees buy players. They don't necessarily need the players, but they want to take those players off the field for other teams. I think VMware is doing the same thing here. Now, it's either going to work and everyone's going to be amazed at the genius, and this is sort of like the reinvention of Microsoft when Satya Nadella took over, or it's going to be a ridiculously bad acquisition and they're going to have to divest them like HP did a few years back. That's more or less an overview.
Chris, you had a question too, right?
I did indeed. And Padre, you were talking about, you know, all of these bits and pieces. You were talking about the idea of being able to run containers on top of virtual machines. When you were talking to people and listening to people at VMworld, is it getting to a point of complexity where the real battle is going to be over the orchestration and automation systems rather than all of the specific virtual machine and container creation and hosting frameworks? I mean, you're starting to get a lot of moving pieces, and we're already seeing some significant security issues from people misconfiguring the darn things.
Yes, yeah, and actually, I think that's what's behind the Bitnami acquisition. So Bitnami provided a write once deploy to many cloud solution. So the idea is you can take pre-built, pre-tested Kubernetes clusters, and then you can modify them slightly and then deploy them automatically. And like you said, that takes a lot of the guesswork away. It's no longer, well, do I go AWS? Do I go Azure? Do I go Google? Am I going to try IBM? Maybe I want to go with a Dell on-prem solution. They're trying to take that away. They don't want that to be a question anymore. They want that to be something that you decide way down the line when you actually start looking at price and how quickly you can scale up solutions. What VMware wants you to do is to say, just stay with us and you can push it everywhere. We are reversing the lock-in. We are reversing this idea that you're going to buy an incredibly expensive infrastructure that you're going to be stuck with for the next 10 years. Now, if they do that, then the question becomes moot as to why you would use VMware. It's, of course you would use VMware because it does everything. It works everywhere. It works with every service. It works with all your VMs. It works with all your containers. And because Dell EMC and VMware are all the same company, it also means those same services that you've deployed out into your public, your private cloud, your hybrid cloud, wherever it might be, can also be accessed by all of your employees everywhere, no matter where they are, no matter what platform they're using, no matter what level of security they need. And because of my acquisitions of something like Carbon Black, it means I can protect my endpoints as well as I can protect my core. That is a compelling story. And more importantly, that is a compelling story that lets most C-level executives ignore all the minutiae that has become so important over the last decade.
Now, interesting enough, they didn't cover too much about networking, but the interesting enough is that VMware has kind of been the king of NSX for a while. In fact, there are some stats they showed is they have 13,000 plus customers, 8 out of 10 top telcos, 88% of the F100 front companies, and they're number one in SD-WAN. Now, the question is, did they show you at all what's next for them here in that space?
Kind of. I think because they're now, it's really, again, you really do have the three big companies. You have EMC, you have Dell, you have VMware. They don't see the need to compete with each other. So if you wanted to find out what they were doing in NetSpace, you went over to the Dell booth. And that's all they were about. If you wanted to find out what they were doing with services and say their flash arrays, you went over to the EMC side. And otherwise, you just talked to the VMware partners. So they haven't abandoned it. They just realized that they don't have to duplicate all the solutions that all their other major partners already have. That's not to say that they don't want the entire pie. It's just to say that they're okay with sharing it with the companies that are basically one entity.
Fantastic. Well, folks, we're running out of time for this part of the segment. We do want to go get to our next guest, but Padre, we would love to have you stay. And I know because you could be part of a great conversation here as we get into AI ops, if you can.
Of course. I'm not going anywhere.
fantastic. Well, folks, that does it for our VMworld coverage. But let's go ahead and bring in this week's guest. It's Dave Link, CEO of Science Logic. Dave, welcome to the show.
Hey, great to be here.
So our audience loves hearing origin stories. Can you maybe take us through your journey and what brought you to ScienceLogic?
I can. I started the company, really, it's that classic entrepreneurial story where you're frustrated by using a whole set of tools to try to see the current state, the situational awareness of a network, a global network with servers, network infrastructure, applications, all the storage arrays. And this was pre-cloud when we started the company, but the challenge hasn't really changed that much. And we've seen over the past 5 years, companies really have to have a digital experience that makes sense for them, for their customers. And that transform enabled by cloud has moved applications to where the data sits. And the data ends up sitting in a lot of locations, whether it's public cloud or private hyper-converged clouds. When you add all that up, it creates a lot of challenges for IT. And that was a problem we were trying to solve code day one, build a solution where you didn't have to have 20-point solutions, where you had one platform to manage infrastructure from top to bottom, from the application all the way through the network layer, so that you get ultimately the right data sets and contextualize it to see problems as they were arising and resolve them before you had an outage.
Now, this is an interesting space because we've actually seen quite a bit of organizations. We've seen like Splunk and MooSoft and some other organizations kind of come into this space as well, which is the whole main focus, like you were saying, is kind of the stream of data and kind of pulling it together, contextualizing it, and just making it useful for organizations. What are kind of some of the areas that ScienceLogic is focusing on from this perspective?
Among the biggest challenges you have is, and I think Curtis said it correctly earlier, there's so much data. There's an exhaust fume of digital performance fault configuration data coming from a set of devices. We see over the last 5 years, the velocity of data, the variety of data, and the kind of technologies that actually deliver that instrumentation are evolving so quickly that whether you think about a configuration of your system and keeping it we've spent a lot of time with DevSecOps, keeping it secure as configurations change with ephemeral systems. They're changing very quickly. Having all of those data silos in one place ends up being kind of the holy grail of the challenge that most organizations are facing. Some products are good at looking at data silos by having those silos send their information northbound. What we have found is that 80% of data scientists that are working basically with these big data sets to predict anomalous behavior don't have the right data sets that they need because they exist in too many silos and they're not then contextualized. So they spend all their time writing algorithms essentially to cleanse the data. About 75-80% of the algorithms are really spent organizing the data. So we built a series of capabilities that translate all of this information that we get directly from the end target technologies at the time of capture. We translate it into a common data format that we can do some really interesting analytics against to ultimately get to automated processes that, based on the predictive behavior, can take proactive resolutions.
Fantastic. Now, Padre, you have a question about data silos.
Yeah, David, I've heard that before, that a lot of these analytics tools are not looking at the data in their data silos properly. And that's kind of become a buzz term in the AI circles. My question is super simple. What did ScienceLogic see about what those tools were doing with the data silos? And what was it specifically wrong about what they were doing with the data in those data silos?
What we saw and what we've been working on for the past 4 or 5 years as we've been looking at container-based microservices and the transition of ephemeral systems that are coming and going, a lot of the traditional tools and silos were looking at just one segment of the entire stack, and they weren't combining together and contextualizing how, as things change, how they relate to one another across the network layer, the OS layer, the virtualized layer, the app layer. And we bring all that, condense it together. The use cases that are especially important are pulling in security information from the traditional infrastructure information. And I think what we've learned, Padre, is applications really have to be infrastructure aware. And right now, the developers are building applications that are really good at understanding how the application is behaving, but presuming that the infrastructure will always be there. And that then causes problems when the infrastructure, for whatever reason, has a problem getting to the root cause, because in some cases with ephemeral systems, you're not sure what infrastructure that application may be tied to. So we've spent a lot of time mapping the full stack, and as it changes and evolves, how it keeps connected to the infrastructure from an application level. So in some cases, we've had to take feeds from APM providers that already have agents enabled across thousands of applications. So that is just another data feed that we then correlate to the network layer, the virtualized layer, all these kind of mesh networks, SD-WANs. You've seen probably another really interesting point that may not be obvious is a lot of these technologies have become virtualized. Virtualized to such a degree that when you talk to an API, that API is actually relating to thousands of different components that are constantly changing, and having to segment each one as its own, in a words, component or device, and understanding how that relates to an aggregate service is a really important delineator. So the service view ends up becoming a really important aspect of ensuring you can get to a fast root cause. And the service, as you know, is then full of all sorts of technologies that move around.
And that absolutely makes sense to me, because when you think about it, most of these tools, including Science Logic, really came onto the market when prem was a standard. Everything was on-prem. And actually, network monitoring was a little bit easier because I just made sure that all of my major components were up, all my major services were available. I could have a single pane of glass, and it shows me any red areas, any trouble tickets that pop up. When I'm dealing with a hybrid deployment, as you said, there are so many dependencies that single pane of glass becomes three-dimensional. It's no longer, well, this is not available, therefore there's something broke in closet 445. It could be, well, this particular service is running on these different clouds, including an on-prem hybrid cloud. So I guess my follow-up for this would be, in Science Logic's view, what is the best way to make those connections? What is the best way to display a potential problem that might touch Azure, AWS, and Google all at the same time?
So what we've realized is that is becoming an increasingly more common configuration. And as a result, as I mentioned, the service view, we've actually come up with an AIOps model, because what we've realized in working with customers around the world is sometimes they're not sure where they sit within the journey. And this is absolutely a journey. It's a journey because you typically have instrumented the network layer or the server layer or the virtualized layer or the cloud layer or the storage layer or the application layer. And often, as you so notably earlier mentioned, those layers had silos of their own data sets. And then you would try to bring it together at yet another layer, which sometimes worked, but oftentimes left a customer without the right data to make a smart decision, whether it was of the right correlation or an automation. And we built this maturity model because we realized back in the day there was a maturity model for IT operations and management. But because AIOps really leverages big data to predict behavior and diagnose root causes, the first thing that we found is you've got to collect the data and cleanse it so that you have it in a format that isn't a data swamp. Often these individual tool sets will create what I would call a swamp. So you've really got to, first of all, collect the data, then organize it properly, and then have the right context of what connects to what. Across, when you see these business services, they're actually made up of compound applications where, as an example, we have a financial services customer who has a credit card authorization system sitting in Azure. They have their web tier sitting out on Amazon, and then some of the back office systems for the bank run in a private data center. But all of those relate to the aggregate service, and now the service health, availability, and risk relates to all the components together working as one. So that's really the change that operations is behind, and one of the things that I think if you haven't really thought through this journey, you're already behind in thinking through how you're going to get the data into a aggregate data lake that's clean and contextualized so that you've got it structured so you can apply the advanced analytics against it. Once you have advanced analytics you can apply against it for predictive behavior, you can then have automation systems, of which we have an automation system embedded in our platform that can take advantage of our analytics to then do remediation and or enrichment of incidents so that when the operator gets the event, he's got a whole set of actions that have already taken place, scripts that have run that then populate within the incident, all of the above scripts that you'd normally run after the fact, but you have it there at the moment the incident's occurred. These scripts kick off, pull in the data, plop it into the incident so that the operator can actually have everything at their fingertips to make smart decisions.
Hey, Dave. This is Brian. Hey, howdy. You know,
hi, Brian.
The School of Ocean Earth Science and Technology is a ScienceLogic EM7 customer. And AI ops just sounds great, especially, you know, in small organizations like we are, that we just do not have enough warm bodies, especially skilled warm bodies. What kinds of things do I need to start looking at if I want to take advantage of AI ops?
Well, the journey from what we have seen over and over again, it starts with a tool that helps discover that you have on your network. And what we've realized is that there are many ways to discover infrastructure. We've actually connected to many of the RESTful APIs of orchestration systems that are deploying systems really in an ephemeral mechanism. So as soon as something's deployed, whether it's on Amazon or Google or Azure or a private VMware cloud, or, you know, as you might recall, we support all the hypervisors, whether it's Hyper-V on the Microsoft side or Citrix Xen or KVM for Red Hat and OpenShift. So, you know, or containers through Kubernetes, you're really having to connect to these orchestration engines. And as things are spun up, we automatically discover them, profile them, put them into the right business service so that all of that work that traditionally was done kind of by hand is done automatically. And I think that's the big difference. You're coming into an era where people can't manage the data flow fast enough. There's too much data coming from too many systems. And because this machine data is kind of the exhaust fumes, as I said earlier, are coming at a very, very fast pace, you've got to basically apply machine learning to the data to look for the patterns that are known patterns that can help us then either get to a faster root cause or a remediation. We have now embedded within the product thousands of automation actions that, based on known patterns, will proactively either resolve issues or, as I said, augment the troubleshooting of a situation with the right data sets that somebody would normally go and do after the fact. But in some cases, that anomaly has already come and gone, and you really want to go and run the script based on that type of anomaly to capture the data that you then an engineer would typically do so that you have it at the time of the incident evaluation. So I think the starting point is really to connect a system that can discover and map your network accurately, keep it up to date as things change with, as I said, whether it's SD-WAN, all of these layers, containers on top of virtual machines, SD-WAN on top of MPLS, vSAN on top of the storage arrays. So you've basically got all these layers have been abstracted away from the core technology that they're sitting on. And so what we've done is we've figured out a way to look at all those abstracted layers, connect them together from a context perspective automatically so that you don't have an operator trying to figure out, is it the storage array? Is it the VM? Is it the network? Is it the security layer? All those data sets really have to come together. Otherwise, you're going to be hunting and pecking in these silos looking for which one's got the root cause.
David, I'm curious about all of this. You know, we're talking about both the volume of input and then the necessary speed of response. You touched on both of those in your last answer. I know that a lot of organizations are reluctant to sort of hand control for automated response over to a system. Where do you find this breakdown? I mean, do you see the companies that are perhaps more committed to a DevOps or DevSecOps operational model being more willing to have automated response on the part of the system, and, you know, say some of the more traditional companies wanting simply to inform their analysts? Are there any patterns that you see in the type of organizational structure mapping to how comfortable they are with the different levels and layers of automation that are possible?
That is a really good question, and it's right at the heart of the kind of customers that we deal with are traditionally large global estates that have infrastructure across many data centers around the world, whether it's a telco or a large Fortune 500 company. Many of the Dow 30 companies now use our product. And what you'll find is that companies that are highly regulated are realizing that they want to go kind of in a step function across this journey. They'll often start out using our automation engine to augment and enrich an event. So let's say we find a correlated event that we're having a problem on a network interface or on a security interface, and we're going to create that event and send it northbound. We then have a series of scripts that often the manufacturer will recommend that you would run. Let's say you call the manufacturer or the team that would be the level two support that would run a set of scripts to look from a diagnosis perspective. The first step along the way, Kurt, is to provide enrichment data so that when that event gets into a workflow, you can take very fast action upon it. And we find that probably 75% of our automation actions are enrichment, where you might have an event that then carries off three or four scripts where you're going to pull the data, stuff all that data within the ticket, append the ticket with not just the event, but the essentially the data that you augment and enrich that event with for the engineer to evaluate. There are other anomalies that we know 99% of the time we can confidently take an action against that'll resolve it. And the comfort level with customers, including Cisco and others, of using automation actions for a range of events, whether it's network or server or virtual machine related, is growing exponentially because, again, things are moving fast enough now where you can't have an operator look at everything manually. And I think the world is getting more comfortable with that, but it's a stair-step approach that really aligns to our AIOps maturity model, that you're going to go through a series of comfort level successes, building upon that to get to more and more what I call remediation operation actions versus enrichment actions.
Okay, when you talk about remediation, one of the other things that we hear spoken about a lot is the move by companies of all sizes to use some sort of virtual SOC, basically SOC as a service, where you've got a partnering organization that's taking care of some level of the analysis, action, and remediation around your security. How complex are you seeing the environments that you're going in terms of having data and alerts going to a third party versus the ultimate customer? Are you seeing these kind of organizationally more complex solutions, or is that something that, from your point of view, might be out there but not among your customer set?
It's a really good point. And what we see, we've had to create an open architecture so that we can share data externally from our platform and send it either northbound to ticketing systems or to other event management systems. But more often, what we see is customers will have the security event from the SIM product sent over to our event correlation engine, and then we'll correlate security events, some that we see natively, some that the SIM might be pulling, and we'll correlate that to other performance and fault and configuration information that we're seeing against a particular device or technology that we have under management. Traditionally, our product discovers everything on the network, every element of the network, and creates that holistic data lake. So I don't think there's one right way to do it. Many service providers, it's actually about 60% of our business, are companies that use our platform to deliver managed services, remotely managed NOC services. And so they'll use our product. They'll then discover a lot of the infrastructure at the customer site. Our product can be delivered via the cloud or on-prem, depending upon the security and compliance requirements. And because of that, it provides a really naturally strong foundation to deliver managed services upon. So that's a very strong part of our business. But nevertheless, if one of our customers is using a managed service provider, we can send our events externally or pull in events from a third party's data stream or event stream into ours, correlate it against the infrastructure that we're aware of, and then give that ultimately that business service view. How is the business service behaving, which often is made up of compound technologies across a variety of clouds?
Oh, Dave, wow, all kinds of changes. Hey, it sounds like I'm a little behind the times on the ScienceLogic platform. What do you think? You think maybe I should try and get to the ScienceLogic Symposia next year?
We'd love you to be there. We'd love you to speak there. And we need to make sure that we keep your system up to date. You know, our product is used across many government entities. The National Weather Service uses our product extensively, NIH, EPA, many state and local governments. It's been a really fabulous journey as we started the company. We really had this vision. The vision that we believed was the right vision was not to have data sit in silos, that data should come together in one common model so that we could do advanced analytics. What you've not been able to enjoy in using our product yet probably is the automation layer that is really kicking some ass in terms of delivering great value to customers. We've seen some of the event streams we've been able to cut down by 60-70% based on not just smart correlation, but smart automation.
You know, David, both T-Bird and I have used ScienceLogic for T-Bird, what it's got to be the better part of 8 years, almost a decade, right?
Almost a decade, yeah.
Almost a decade. And so both of us know how nice it is to have a tool that is proactive. Both of us know how nice it is to have a tool that can really give you visibility into your network. But I know there's going to be a lot of people listening to or watching this show who are going to say, it's just for the big boys. It's just for the big league. It's just for enterprises with that mythical 10,000 seat capacity. It's not for companies that are in the minor leagues. It's not for companies that are just starting out. It's not something that I can start to use with my, you know, 100 seat company and get the kind of enrichment that you've been talking about. Could you give me a scenario, a realistic scenario of how a company can bring ScienceLogic in and then grow with ScienceLogic and get that enrichment all along the way of their development journey?
Well, one of the things that I believed from the beginning was we had to make the business model simple. And we've spent a lot of time making it simpler over the years. We now have moved to a model where we, again, can deploy the product in any of the clouds or on-prem, depending upon the customer's requirements. Same product, same ISO, but we just charge per device. And you can start out with as little as 100 devices. And a device is traditionally a switch, a route, firewall, something that's got an IP addressable space. It could be a virtual machine or it could be a storage array. In some cases, it could be cloud elements. So, as I said, whether it's for containers, we have a licensing model that's very efficient and easy on the wallet to make sure that for micro services that you're not counting them as an actual device. But we don't charge per interface. We don't charge as a lot of vendors will charge for the data volume that's coming from these devices. We collect an extraordinary amount of information from the devices that we have in our management, including containers and cloud systems. So what I'd say, the one thing that I've learned is the companies that charge based on data volume, it's an interesting way to charge, but ultimately you really need to see the service, and the service is made up of a bunch of things that could sit in a lot of different locations. So we've really crystallized the model that it's a device model, and it can start really small. It's very easy to get up and running. It can be up and running in just a few minutes based on our cloud instance. And as a result, then you put in your credentials for whatever you want to discover. And it kicks off that discovery. And within really a few minutes, you have a visual picture of your public clouds, your private clouds, your network layer, the virtualized layer of either SD-WAN or your SAN environment or your container environment. So I think the one thing that we've learned over the years is that IT doesn't come in one flavor. There's we were working with a customer last week that was doing some very clever things with SD-WAN, and that seems to be crossing the chasm beyond just an interesting idea to a fairly significant sprint. In the early days of new technologies, people like to often consume it as a managed service to make it simple for them. But now, once you cross that chasm, customers want a tool to help manage that layer so that they could get that connected with the rest of the stack that they're operating, whether it's all these branch offices and then the infrastructure at those branch offices. So the service view has really become the view that customers need to think about in an era of cloud. It really isn't a device era, it's the service era. And I know I've just talked about the device pricing, but the device pricing is the simplest way that we can get customers started fast.
Unfortunately, we run low on time, but Dave, thank you so much for being here. We really appreciate you being on This Week in Enterprise Tech.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Absolutely.
It's great to see you all again.
Great to see you as well. Now, before we close up, we do want to give you a chance to tell us a little bit about ScienceLogic, where customers can go to find out more, to get started, all that type of stuff.
Sure. It's ScienceLogic.com, and you can click on and get to a trial or a free demo. We don't charge for demonstrations or trials of the product. So that's something where we traditionally want customers to be really happy that they're getting a product that meets their needs and solves problems they really care about.
Fantastic. Well, folks, you've done it again. You've sat through another hour of Best Staying Enterprise podcast in the universe, according to 9 out of 10 conference massage stations. But I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially my co-host in crime and our special guest, Padre SJ. Padre, thank you so much for coming back and sharing VM World with us, and for just showing us your grace and being with us this episode. But aww, can you tell the folks at home where they can find you, your work, and where they can follow you?
First of all, it's great to be back. I mean, I've been gone for more than a year, and it feels like I'm just slipping right back in because you guys are just awesome. You can find me no matter where I might be. Most of the time I'm in the Vatican, but I do travel quite a lot for work now, at Twitter, twitter.com/PadreSJ. That's the easiest way to find me and also the easiest way to see some of the new content that I've been making. The last year I've been focusing on content that doesn't have me in front of the camera, but that's going to be changing because I may have appropriated a rooftop studio and have finally had time to fit it out. So hopefully I'll be making content again. So again, twitter.com/PadreSJ. Oh, yeah, by the way, that's what happens in my house. We get these guests, these visitors who just show up and they never announce themselves, and it's super, super annoying.
Fantastic. Thanks, Padre. Of course, we have to thank our very own Mr. Curtis Franklin, senior editor at Dark Reading. Curtis, where can the folks find you? What's coming up for you and all of your work?
Well, you can find me, of course, at Dark Reading, mostly these days over in a section called The Edge, where I'm doing a little bit longer form work, some features, some explainers. I'm going to be talking about what FPGAs mean to security, both good and bad. I also have an article coming up on why VPNs are necessary, but not necessarily only good for security. So that's going to be happening. Also wanted to point out, follow me on Twitter at KG4GWA. I'm going to have a tweet coming up with a link to this make-a-thon I'm participating in next weekend. That's the second weekend of September, supporting STEM education and makers in Central Florida. These are happening all over the place. Mine tends to be in Central Florida. Would love it if you take a look. I'm going to be covering it in my own personal blog and all of that. And if you'd care to support STEM education and makers in Central Florida, there's a place for you to do that as well.
Fantastic. Thanks, Kurt. Well, last but not least, our other co-host in crime and our Twiets producer and our geek in paradise, Mr. Brian G. Chiebert. Where can the folks find you, your work, and how to pitch you some ideas?
Well, I am also on Twitter at ADVNETLAB, Advanced Net Lab, or feel free to drop me a line. I'm Chiebert at twit.tv, but I would really suggest, why don't you drop your line to Twiet at twit.tv, and that way the email will hit all the hosts. We'd love to hear you. We'd love to hear your show ideas. We've been using those, and I've been fishing for guests. And, you know, hey, we're going to have all kinds of fun. And, yes, I am lining up another big guest for Chiebert's Kitchen, where we get to go and do a deep dive on different technologies. We'll just have to wait and see and make sure the guest that wants to do this actually really and truly is going to commit some really tasty engineering for us to talk about.
Thanks, Chiebert. Also, thank you to you as well. You're the person who drops in each and every week to watch and listen to our show to get your enterprise goodness. We want to make it easy for you to watch and listen. And go to our show page right now, twit.tv/Twiet. There you'll find all the amazing back episodes, plus all the show notes, co-host information, guest information, links to the stories that we do during the show. Plus, more importantly, next to the video there or below the video, you'll actually see all the links to actually use your podcast application of your choice or your stream of your choice to basically subscribe. Apple Podcasts, Google, all the different ones, YouTube. Go ahead and subscribe. That's how you support our show, and we want to make sure we can continue to do it. So by subscribing, you can support us. And in fact, after you subscribe, share with your friends, share with your coworkers, share with your family. We love doing the show, and that's how we keep doing it. Now, if you want to watch the show live, we also do it live each and every week, Friday, 1:30 p.m. Pacific time at live.twit.tv. And of course, if you're going to watch the show live, you might as well jump into the chat room live as well. We have a great chat room, some fancy characters in there giving us some great content and questions during the show. That's irc.twit.tv. Also, don't forget you can follow me at twitter.com/LouMM. Of course, you can see all the work that I do during my normal daily work hours. Of course, all the work that I do and fancy projects that I do during the weekend, I'll post there as well. Of course, you can check out the work that I do at Microsoft by going to dev.office.com. There you see all the latest and greatest ways to customize Office and make it more productive for you and your organization. I also want to make sure I thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to Leo and Lisa. They continue to support us each and every week doing This Week in Enterprise Tech, and we couldn't do the show without them and their support. Of course, we want to thank all the engineers at Twit, and of course, our loyal producer and our co-host in crime, Mr. Brian Chi. He does all the bookings, the plannings for the show, and we really couldn't do the show without him. And of course, we have to thank our TD for today. Victor's back. Padre, you wanted to personally thank him, right?
Of course. I mean, it was always fun to have Victor in the studio because I could turn to him during the show and we could crack jokes. Although he just reminded me that today is episode 357 and we didn't make any Magnum jokes. So that's not great. Of course, Victor, we have to ask, remember, we'll bring back this tradition. We want to know if you were actually paying attention. So if there was one thing that today's episode was about, what would you say it was?
I think, first of all, it's good to have you back, Padre. Mm. And second of all, it's I found that you can bring baseball into anything.
This is true. This is true.
So maybe we need to go to an A's game or something.
Yes.
This weekend.
Or Giants.
A's.
Mm.
Giants. A's.
Thanks again, Lou.
Fantastic. Well, folks, until next time, I'm Louis Maresca, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the Enterprise, just keep quiet.